G'day. Andy Ward is my name. Thank you so much for your company today. You are listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues and events around the Bega Valley. Now this week, we're doing things a little bit different. I'm going to hand the whole episode over to my friend and yours, our regular guest, Graham Farram. You might have heard in recent weeks that Australian Community Media, the organisation that owns, among other things, our local paper here in the Bega Valley, the Bega District News, has axed a whole lot of local newspapers around regional Australia. We were lucky enough to find that this paper, the Bega District News, survived that event. But it led me to think about where the Bega District News had come from. So I set Graham a task to look back at the history of the Bega District News. So here he is, the former proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega, an artist and a long-term member of the Bega Pioneers Museum, Mr. Graham Farram.
I made a New Year's resolution once, a couple of years back. It's the only one I've ever made and the only one that I've ever tried to keep. And that was to go around to the office and actually buy the newspaper directly from the office. And that was good because they were always friendly and there was often a question that I had as well, and they were always very, very helpful. But I thought to try and get a little bit of an idea of the newspapers, I'd go back to The History of Bega by W.A. Bailey. Now, the copy that I'm looking at was republished by the Bega Valley Historical Society. From the introduction, this was the introduction to the 1987 edition because the original had been out of print for a while. This is by G.G. Monaghan, dated the 30th of August, 1987, just a little bit. Bill W.A. Bailey taught fifth grade at Bega Primary School in the late 40s and 50s. His passion for local history and his habit of spending long hours with dusty newspapers and old identities was considered by locals to be somewhat eccentric, to say the least. If Cicero was right in saying, not to know what happened before you were born is to be ever a child, then it is high time Bailey's well-documented story of Bega's beginnings be reprinted. Now, that was for 1987. The Bega Valley Historical Society Incorporated received permission from Father G.G. Monaghan, editor of the 1987 edition, to reprint, correct, and update the story of the settlement and development of Bega by W.A. Bailey. The original book was written in 1942, and Sandra Florence and Linda Elliott did this work for the Historical Society in August 2013. So it had been out of print for a little bit of a while. Very interesting historian is William Bailey. As he travelled around as a teacher, I believe, he went to lots of places, and if they didn't have a local history, well, he wrote one. And I don't know, it amounts to about 20 of them, the history of Campbelltown, the history of Albury, just a whole armful of them. But, of course, you don't see them very often because they're the sort of things that people hang on to. So they don't get out there very much. So it's good when these things are reprinted. But I've got a copy that's from our local library. You can actually buy copies of this, the 2013 edition, from the Bega Pioneers Museum when we reopen. But here we go from pages 44 and 46. This is a history of the press up to about 1900. The town's development was fostered by the early establishment of the local press. The Illawarra Mercury was established in Wollongong in 1855 and covered the whole area from Wollongong and Goulburn to the Victorian border. It was newsy and readable. Its correspondents were well organised, and it carried local news of all important centres, including Bega, Twofold Bay. With the Kyandra gold rushes in 1860, Eden had two newspapers, Twofold Bay and Manaroo Telegraph, and the Twofold Bay and Manaroo Observer. Both these carried Bega news, but the former ran for only 6 months, and the latter for nine. The Telegraph, begun on June the 2nd, possibly 1860, was royal folio size, contained general and local news, and was published and printed by Harnett and Co. Twofold Bay, twice weekly for sixpence per copy. In October, William Shaw was editor, but the paper ceased publication at the end of the year. The Observer was begun at Eden on October the 21st, 1860, and was printed and published by J.R. Edwards for the proprietors. It was double royal size and issued twice weekly for sixpence per copy. From Wednesday the 23rd, 1861, it appeared only once weekly, and after March 30 was published by Edwards and Ryle until it was discontinued on June 29th. Both papers were forced to cease publication by the loss of patronage caused by the failure at Kyandra and the rushes to the newly established gold fields at the Gulf, Narragunda. In 1863, the Maruya Examiner was established, whilst in 1864, Bega's first paper, the Bega Gazette, was established by Robert William Sharp in the premises known as the Post Office Stores, in the then centre of the town, near the school in Lower Auckland Street, later known as Paternoster Row for some years. It was a foolscap weekly, printed on an Albion press, and sold at threepence per copy at first. In 1866, its size was increased to 12 inches by 18 inches when folded, and the price increased to fourpence. In July 1869, the paper was bought by Tyrone White, whose backer was Reverend J. L. Knight, an English-type parson and Bega's first rector, who had ideas of making it a church paper. After 4 months, Robert Burgess took over, increased the subscription from 3 and 6 to 5 shillings per quarter, and enlarged the paper to double demi size. W. H. Brain bought him out in 1870 and sold to Oswald Welby in 1877. Brain repurchased in 1881 and began a twice-weekly issue. In 1868, the Southern Standard, sponsored by R.W. Sharp, began in opposition, and in 1872, P. Quinlivan purchased it, making the fourth or fifth change since its establishment. Byrne bought him out in 1873, and after his death in 1874, L.J. O'Toole and Neely took it over, it then being double royal size with a circulation of 400 issued weekly. They changed its name to the Bega Standard. In 1900, two Bega men, P. Tarlington and Walter Smith, purchased the Bega Gazette for £360, changed its banner to the Southern Star. Well, 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 what a lot of changes in all of that, and what a lot of people. On another occasion, I'll come back to some of those folks because they were interesting in the history of Bega. And it shows what a volatile sort of business being in the newspaper industry is, journalism. All of those paper sizes and what things cost. Oh, dear. As a bookseller, I'm a bit aware of what paper sizes books are and decimal currency replacing our old pounds, shillings and pence. There was a poem written by a gentleman called John Dengate, late of Cobarga. This was published in the Penguin Book of Australian Humorous Verse, compiled by Bill Scott, Penguin Book Australia, 1984. And this is on page 91. And I thought, gee, there was a, I grew up just when it was too late to learn metrics properly. I've already done all that imperial stuff. But here's John Dengate, anti-metrics. This is Comments and Curses, is the chapter of the Book of Australian Humorous Verse. 3 pounds of pumpkin, 2 inches of rain, 1 gallon of beer and 1 bushel of grain, 6-furlong race round the old Randwick track, bringing the imperial measurements back, packets of butter and cheeses and hams, or to be measured in pounds, not in grams. As for kilometres, I've often thought, they'd like to be miles, but they're too bloody short. All cricket pitchers should measure a chain. Metric conversion is simply insane. Give back our pint, fluid ounces and quarts. Metrics are nothing but fly specks and naught. Kick the convention board right in the pants. Take up a collection and send them to France. Hands off that hundredweight. Don't touch that ton. Who asked the bastards to do what they've done? They foisted it on us in usual style. We gave them an inch and they've taken a mile. Millimetres. Now that's a French farce. And hectares especially are a pain in the arse. This bloke at the gas company weighed 15 stone, 6 foot of manhood, all muscle and bone. One day a metre fell down on his head. Murdered by metrics, the coroner said. 3 pounds of pumpkin, 2 inches of rain, 1 gallon of beer and 1 bushel of grain, 6-furlong race round the old Randwick track, bring the imperial measurements back. Well, that was quite an effort. He was sort of known in the area for being rather quick to turn out a poem. He might be sitting there reading the newspaper, and by the time he'd finished it, he'd go straight into writing a bit of a satirical political poem about what he'd read. Okay, now I am actually going back to The History of Bega by Bill Bailey. I've moved on to the biographical section, page 99-100, and that's William Henry Brain, JP, 1839-1918, who purchased the paper, sold it, and then purchased it back again and ran it for a while. The sources used by Bailey to do this biography come from Diary of W.H. Brain, which was in the possession of Mrs. R.V. Ritchie of Bega. This would be in 1942. The Southern Star, the 20th of the 3rd, 1918. Now, that might well be an obituary. And a gentleman called, well, I'm going to say his name is Ray, R-E-A, a book he wrote called I Sought Adventure. And this is rather good biography. It's in the back of the book, page 9900. Probably the most learned early resident of Bega had was W.H. Brain, who was born in Tenby, South Wales, in May 1839, son of the Reverend Josiah Brain of the Congregational Church. He lived in New York from 1843 to 1846, moving to Canada, and then in 1857 to Braidwood, New South Wales, where he edited the first daily newspaper outside Sydney, the Braidwood Daily News, in the days of the Goldburn. In 1862, he married Martha Ogilvy. Later, he returned to Canada, but subsequently settled at Glen William, New South Wales, on a tributary of the Hunter in 1864. In 1865, when his diary starts in earnest, he arrived in Bega to take up duty at the National School. He arrived at Merimbula and drove up the coast road in a two-horse spring wagon with Rickson. He mentions that he drove along the beach for 1/4 mile at Bornda, the journey to Bega taking 7.5 hours for the 25 miles. During his time at the school, he worked for the establishment of the bank in Bega, the Commercial Bank of Sydney, opening a branch in 1867. After ably conducting the school for 3 years, he took up farming at Tanger. returning in 1870 to purchase the Vega Gazette, which he subsequently conducted on free trade principles for 30 years, with the exception of the years 1877 to 1881, when it was owned by Oswald Welby, until circulation dwindled, and he sold out to Tarlington and Smith, who changed it to the Southern Star. Brain then kept a stationery business in Church Street. Brain was a classical scholar who knew several languages and was a forceful and independent character, holding steadfastly to his opinions, whether popular or not. He was described as a man who courted no man's favour and feared no man's frown. And he was often in conflict with his fellow workers. This trait left him with few friends, and this sometimes grieved him. When J.G. Beasley arrived to open Vega's first bank and visited him one evening, he wrote, "There will be something new in the experience of my life if I made a friend of him. Is it my fault that I do not make friends?" S.J. Ray says of him, "I found Mr. Brain, my employer, a man of intellectual type, but not very approachable." And he goes on, "Mr. Brain gave me no opening for original work of any kind in the paper, and dismissed him because I had displayed little enterprise in collecting news for the paper." However, Ray takes some blame himself and describes Brain as public-spirited, educated, dignified and reserved, but not sociable. He seldom spoke to his employees. He often suffered caustic criticism, but gave it equally to others. For many years, he played a foremost part in public affairs in Vega, being closely associated with every public movement and assisted the foundation of many institutions. He occupied positions as secretary to the School of Arts, Agricultural Society, Vega District Jockey Club, Vega District Hospital, and was elected alderman of Vega Municipal Council in 1888, holding his seat for many years. He was appointed JP in 1896 and deputy coroner and guardian of miners in 1910. Throughout his life, he was a regular attendant at all churches in Vega, and his diary provides much evidence of the attention he gave the sermons, a record of the text for the services and the preacher's name being recorded for each Sunday. Well, again, another very dense piece of work by Bill Bailey, and we'll unpack a little bit of that as the weeks go on. But in my independent reading, I'd been reading something, you know, just a little bit different. I'd read it before. Brain, as a classical scholar, would probably have read the Theban plays, King Oedipus, Oedipus of Colonus, and Antigone. The copy that I have is a Penguin classic, Sophocles, of course, translated by E.F. Watling. It's a reprint of 1949. The introduction, which is dated 1946, just two little bits out of this. Sophocles the Athenian was born in 1496 BC and lived 90 years. A memoir written by an anonymous scholar of a later age, perhaps 200 years after the poet's death, gives us a picture of his life which we may take to be substantially true in outline and in spirit, though some of its circumstantial details may be apocryphal. A picture of a childhood spent under the best influences of a prosperous and enlightened home, a youth educated in a harmonious physical and intellectual discipline, and endowed with grace and accomplishment, a manhood devoted to the service of the state in art and public affairs, and an old age regarded with affectionate respect. He lived through a cycle of events spatially narrow, no doubt, in the scale of national and global history, but without parallel in intensity of action and motion, and of lasting significance in the procession of human achievement. Somebody said to me, "Graham, while you're doing these historical recordings, are you going to do something modern? Well, eventually, I'll get onto a bit more modern things. But I thought in this time of social restrictions that this little bit out of Antigone, I'm on pages 135 and 136, the book has been heavily annotated by somebody who's been using it as a study version. And they picked this little bit out as the ode to man. Now, this is spoken by the chorus, whose task was to comment on the action of the play. So a bit like the editor of a newspaper, if you want to make an analogy. Okay, here's the chorus. Wonders are many on earth, and the greatest of these is man, who rides the ocean and takes his way through the deeps, through windswept valleys of perilous seas that surge and sway. He is master of ageless earth, to his own will bending the immortal mother of gods by the sweat of his brow as year succeeds to year with toil unending of mule and plough. He is lord of all living things, birds of the air, beasts of the field, all creatures of sea and land he taketh, cunning to capture and ensnare with sleight of hand. Hunting the savage beast from the upland rocks, taming the mountain monarch in his lair, teaching the wild horse and the roaming ox his yoke to bear. The use of language, the wind-swift motion of brain he learned, found out the laws of living together in cities, building him shelter against the rain and wintry weather. There is nothing beyond his power. His subtlety meeteth all chance, all danger conquereth. For every ill, he has found its remedy, save only death. Oh, wondrous subtlety of man that draws to good or evil ways. Great honour is given and power to him who upholdeth his country's laws and the justice of heaven. But he that, too rashly daring, walks in sin in solitary pride to his life's end, at door of mine shall never enter in. To call me friend. That's pretty good for some time in the 5th century BC, sometime around there. The Ode to Man, that was called by the student who was studying Antigone by Sophocles. I was listening to the radio the other day and Paul Kelly, the musician, was on. And I didn't know, but he said lots of poetry to music. Gerald Manley Hopkins, Shakespeare. He was extolling Keats and his Ode to Autumn. So I decided I'd better try and have a look and see if I could find it. And I eventually did in a little book called The Poet's World by James Reeves. But something that I learned working through the catalogue at the museum was that, you know, if I was looking for a particular object, it was always a good idea to go back a few pages and go forward a few pages, because it might just be that that object was recorded with a whole lot of things that were all related. Well, of course, this is a book of poetry, and so I couldn't help, you know, turn over the pages a little bit. And I was absolutely stunned by this poem, and it was serendipitous is the word I'm looking for, I think, and it made me feel very, very good. This is Walt Whitman. It's on page 200. It's a Heinemann Limited book. This is the first general edition published in 1951. James Reeves was the editor. And there are student notes again, and there are notes in the back, which are all very, very good. No notes on this one, just a short one called Beginning My Studies. Beginning my studies, the first step pleased me so much. The mere fact of consciousness, these forms, the power of motion, the least insect or animal, the senses, eyesight, love, the first step, I say, awed me and pleased me so much, I've hardly gone and hardly wished to go any further, but stop and loiter all the time to sing it in ecstatic song. On page 201, there's one called Animals. It's from the Song of Myself. And I myself might do that one at a later time. But it made me remember that beginning my studies, that I'd had the most, an extraordinary experience. Like everybody else, well, everybody who's got a garden, I guess. In these times, I found myself out in the garden, you know, getting the weeds out, you know, mulching things down, planting this, planting that, moving the pot. Well, I moved a pot, and it was just an unexpected thing. There was a frog. Now, when I first came here, there were green frogs. They don't live here anymore, or at least I haven't heard of them. But there is a little frog. It's a brown frog, and it's got a sort of stripe down the side. Litanoria, from the genus Pelodryadidae, a tree frog. There are 90 species in Australia and Asia. This one's east and south of Malaysia in Sydney. And it's right down here, and it's been here the whole time I've been here. I've got frogs who spawn in my backyard, which is lovely, in a pond that we have. It's got four fish in it at the moment, which is nice. It's just been cleaned. I remember the day when I had to protect it from the heron, who decided, oh, yeah, there's a feed there. And I've seen the herons around town. You'll see them too, and sometimes in somebody's garden. But it sent me to look for a frog poem to go with Walt Whitman. I've got a little book here. It's called The Little Book of Australian Children's Rhymes. It was published by the National Library of Australia in 2004. And this is a poem on page 23 by poet and author Colin Teely, The Green Frog. Because he sits there all alone on his wet and weedy stone, while his chest heaves in and out in a breathless sort of pout, you would think he'd swum a race as fast and a frantic pace, and he was resting to regain his strength and stamina again. But actually, this little king hasn't done a single thing except to sit there all the while with a wide and gummy smile. And certainly my frog would have been happy, I think, to stay under the pot that I picked him up from, but he popped in under the porch, and I imagine he and other members of his family are doing well in my garden, but I do wish it would rain. Once I had a book from the library called The Puffin 20th Century Collection of Verse, edited by Brian Patton. The Puffin book, Penguin 1999, nice big one. A few poems in there. There's a Judith Wright on magpies, which is rather good. But this one by Hilaire Belloc, The Frog, is where I'm going to finish up today, and I'm going to give you an admonition. Be kind and tender to the frog, and do not call him names as Slimy Skin or Pollywog, or likewise Uncle James or Gapergrin or Toad Gone Wrong, or Billy Bandy Knees. The frog is justly sensitive to epithets like these. No animal will more repay a treatment kindly fair. At least so lonely people say who keep a frog. And by the way, they are extremely rare. So enjoy the natural world that comes to you while you're at home. And I hope that we'll be able to talk again next week, Indy.
I hope so too, mate. Thank you so much. Graham Farram is a long-term local here in the Bega Valley. He's been a member of the Bega Pioneers Museum for quite a while now. And we'll catch up with him each week to find out what little tidbit he's found about the history of the Bega Valley and the people that live in it. You're listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues and events taking place around the Bega Valley. My name's Indy Wood. And you can find all the details you want about The Local Update at indymedia.com.au. Thank you for your company again this week. Next week, we're going to catch up with my friend Jan Harris, who lost her family home in the bushfires in Tathra in 2018, to check out how they're going with the redevelopment of their block and what Jan thinks might need to happen with the Bushfire Royal Commission, which has just finished receiving submissions this week. I'll catch you again next week. Thank you again for your company. Bye now.